In October, Tynwald members agreed a slightly watered-down proposal to tie the minimum wage to the living wage. This led to the local economy forum holding a lively meeting which, while highly critical of government and Tynwald's decision, suggested a change to tax allowances and credits which would see the lowest paid taking home slightly more money and government and the private sector sharing the burden. Laurie Hooper spoke against the Tynwald compromise and Chris Robertshaw led the private sector charge. They join me now in the studio. In this instance, Chris, you have a title of sorts.
Well, yes, just one of a number of people involved in the local economy forum. The specific interest at this moment, obviously, being the proposed and now passed minimum wage proposals in Tynwald.
What is the local economy forum?
It's a group of people who've come together from the private sector, generally smaller businesses, who are getting increasingly anxious about the way things are going and felt that they had a specific message to get over in a particular set of areas, and this one, the minimum wage, is the first.
Clearly, there is a difference of opinion, certainly between yourselves and in terms of the Council of Ministers, and I guess Tynwald, in as much as Tynwald has supported a proposal to not quite get to the living wage, but getting pretty close to the living wage. But you're concerned about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Tynwald meant well, and I would support that that feeling that it's very, very important to do everything we can to get lower incomes up. With that, I have absolutely no problem at all, nor do the members of the forum. The problem is that when Treasury put forward its proposals, it didn't explain what the impact would be on the lower paid. They talked about the gross top line figure, and everybody went, well, almost everybody, I think there was six or seven who didn't, and they nodded and they said, yes, well, that's right, that's good. What they didn't understand, and what Treasury absolutely failed to explain, is the tax take, the NI and tax take out of that is very, very significant. And if you went over the life of this House, you could reasonably say two things. First of all, at the beginning of this administration, the government was taking from those on minimum rate of pay at that time 8% of that gross amount. And now it's creeping up to 14, 15%. And it begs the question, what the hell is the minimum wage about? Is it about government collecting tax and insurance, or is it about making sure we protect those on lowest pay? Now, you could say many, many things about the UK at the moment, many of them quite alarming, but one of the simple things that they do recognise is that it's important to make sure that those on lower rates of pay don't pay too much tax and insurance. So, for example, the NI threshold on the Isle of Man, the employee's threshold, is somewhere between £8,000 and £9,000. So anything above that, they pay NI at 11%. In the UK, a person on the same wage, if you like, doesn't start paying NI till they get to between 12 and 13,000. Second point is that on the Isle of Man, that employee will pay 11% from the 8,000 threshold. And in the UK, it's 8%. And actually, you're hearing rumbles over there that they're going to consider in the budget later this month the possibility of moving 2% of the NI over to tax, pay as you earn, PAYE. So they could be, their lower paid staff could be on 6% NI with a higher threshold, and ours remain on 11 with a much lower threshold point. The other thing as well is that because the thresholds generally, the NI's moved over the last 4 or 5 years, but not much, the entry point threshold, you know, the primary gate, if you like, has moved. But the tax allowance has hardly moved at all. I mean, it should be in inflationary terms now. If inflation was applied to the personal tax allowance, it's not much short of 20,000. So what I'm trying to explain here, perhaps badly, is that the lower paid really get hammered if they don't see these thresholds move up. Problem that the government's got is that the quicker the thresholds move up, and they could do to protect the lowest paid, it would be right across the board at that level. The result is that government couldn't afford it. So what the forum has said is, look, what we need to do here is recognise the special circumstances that the lowest paid have got, and, as it were, reduce the increase of tax insurance coming to government for the lowest paid, and by applying an element of credit. I hope I'm not going on too long, Phil, but what the forum has proposed is saying, no, what really, really matters here is not the gross pay, which Alex Allinson keeps talking about and saying how wonderful it is. It's what people take home in pay, in their pocket, to deal with inflation. And so our approach is to say, if you apply a tax credit for those people on the minimum rate of pay, and two, an element of credit for, as it were, a slope away from that as you go higher, so that it isn't a shock when you come out of the minimum rate of pay, that would cost government around about £4 or 5 million if it was very focused. But the gain back from that, the extra money in the economy, the significantly reduced damage on business, because business would be required to increase its pay more or less by inflation, and that's all. So businesses would gain, those on minimum rate of pay would gain, and so would government, because at a net level, and this is important, is at the net take home pay level, the figure that we propose is £370 a year more than the government's proposal. But if you worked it back on the government systems, we've actually arrived at the living wage. And so it's win, win, win. And okay, as far as government income is concerned, if we're in a situation now where a bloated government with very significant wage and salary costs is dependent upon how much tax they rip off the lowest paid, then, Phil, we've got a problem.
Laurie Hooper, I saw shaking your head. I mean, I think I saw a few nods, but generally there was a shaking of the head towards the end there. I mean, you actually didn't support the proposal that Tinwald ended up supporting. I mean, your view was that actually the living wage was what had been recommended. It was what Tinwald originally had agreed to, and this 66% of median wage was a bit of a cop-out. Is that a fair...
I mean, linking the minimum wage to the median wage actually makes no sense for a lot of reasons. I mean, what does the amount of money that someone in e-gaming gets paid, what relevance does that have to how much a restaurant worker earns? None at all. It's nonsense. And it's further compounded by the Alleman's kind of slightly unusual position in the way that our public sector works. The pay there is quite a bit higher in a lot of cases. So linking the median wage to the minimum wage makes no sense. And actually, it's a point that I've made repeatedly to Tinwald, is that no one else does this. The Republic of Ireland actually have announced they're going to change the way they calculate their living wage in a similar way. But actually, other than them, pretty much no one else is interested in this approach, because it is a cop-out. And the UK government did it years ago with their national living wage. It's just a minimum wage. It isn't actually related in any way, shape or form to the cost of living. And that's something that I think Chris has got right here. It's got to be about net pay. It's got to be about what people take home. And that's why the living wage calculation is the right place to start, because that takes account of things like tax thresholds and credits and benefits and all the rest of it. And it says if you pay someone that amount of money, they will have enough to take home at the end of the day that they can live off. And the really good thing about that calculation is you can change that headline rate by changing your tax policy. So if, for example, government decided to change national insurance rates, which they should, if they decided to change the way the employer threshold works again, which they should, that would all result in a lower living wage figure because people would need to earn less because government is taking a bit less out from the underneath. So actually switching to this new methodology, which was endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce, it is a cop-out. Those are your words, and I'm happy to agree with that. It is absolutely a cop-out. It hasn't helped anyone in any way, shape or form. And part of the problem they've got now is if this is where they're going to stick, it's going to be really hard for government to influence that figure because, contrary to what people might believe, government can't directly influence median wages on the Isle of Man. And so if we're saying to businesses out there, actually, it doesn't matter what government policy is, really all that matters in terms of calculating your wages is going to be how much everyone else pays, that's just daft. I mean, what is the government thinking that's going to happen next year if there's another round of overinflationary pay increases in the public sector? That's going to have a knock-on impact. The whole thing, it falls down. It's like a stack of cards built on sand. It is not going to stack up. And I think you've seen that with businesses coming out saying, actually, this isn't right, this isn't helpful. The other thing I'd say is when Timwald originally said, we're going to move to a living wage, you know, over 5 years, that was the plan. The intention was always that government would provide support, because there is a lot of work businesses need to do to change the way they operate in order to make sure they can pay staff more. And some of that is around investing in things that help them be more productive or more efficient or reduce their costs. But government hasn't really done that for all these sectors. And that's part of the problem, is you've got, you know, construction, you've got restaurants, you've got hotels. Actually, there's not a lot of support on the table to do some of these things. Government will help you do energy efficiency, which is great, but actually, aside from that, there's not a lot else. And when I talk to businesses, they don't want handouts. What they want is to be treated fairly. And I don't think that is in any way unreasonable, to be honest, to ask that. The only thing I would disagree with Chris on...
Oh, alas, thank goodness. Yeah. we've been in total agreement so far, which must be very disappointing.
It's where he says the proposal they've got here would actually result in a living wage being paid. It wouldn't. That isn't right. The living wage on the Isle of Man at the moment is being calculated at £13.74.
That's correct, and I agree with you, but I should have explained myself in more detail, because for the very reason, Laurie, that you made about this relationship with other incomes like e-gaming and government, we absolutely agree with you. And what we're saying is that the UK living wage is much more sophisticated in the way it's assembled, and is much more relevant, therefore, to this. So actually, I hate to say it, Phil, but thus far, I hope we find something that we argue about. We're in total agreement here.
But, Laurie, I mean, effectively, what Timwald supported, I mean, when you look at the figures produced by the local economy forum, government's trying to have its cake and eat it, really, isn't it?
So this is part of the problem, is if you look at the way tax is raised on the Isle of Man, our tax base is predominantly working people. That's where the money comes from. It's income tax and national insurance layered with VAT. VAT is predominantly paid by people buying things. Tends to be people on low to medium incomes. That's where most of their spending comes from. And again, income tax and national insurance is largely paid by, again, people on low earnings, because we have all sorts of weird and wonderful caps and structures that kind of are designed to do that. So whenever government tries to make changes at the bottom end, it's very expensive. What the economic strategy said they needed to do, again, 5 years ago, was to say, let's stop moving away from that tax model, because that tax model of putting the burden on working people is not sustainable in the long run, because there are only so many working people on the island, and you cannot keep loading costs onto that group of people over and over again. The end result of that has been Treasury unwilling to look seriously at tax policy. And so there's loads of things they could be doing. So they have, for example, introduced a taper at the top end of the income tax now, so that when you're earning over £100,000, you start to lose your personal allowance.
And is it Treasury that's unwilling, or is it Council of Ministers that's unwilling?
Well, I'd say it's both. Actually, my engagement with Treasury has been relatively negative on tax policy reform ever since I was first elected. But, I mean, taking national insurance is probably the best example here, because we're talking about businesses. NI is probably a bigger cost to most businesses than income tax will be. And so government needs to look at the way NI is raised. Now, it's split in half, national insurance for employers and employees. Employees' national insurance is hard to mess with, because people have to pay certain amounts in to get certain amounts out. It's all all these benefits are linked to it, fine. So you could look at changing the rates and the thresholds, which is probably sensible, but you probably couldn't go much further. Where you could really do some real magic is with the employer's national insurance, because actually that is basically a payroll tax. And you could do anything with that. You can change the thresholds, you could disconnect it from employer's national insurance numbers, you could change the rates, you could offer reliefs or incentives. There's lots of things you could do with that tax structure to help small businesses. And unfortunately, government just has never been interested in looking at these things.
Actually, what Laurie is saying here is actually very, very close to what I'm saying. So this concept of a credit can be structured however you want to structure it, because in the end, I think we're a little bit religious, aren't we, about the separation between tax and NI. Actually, in the end, it's government income and it's government expenditure. And again, I'm going to agree with Laurie. There's an awful lot of hard thinking got to be done in Treasury. It's clumsy and it's clunky. And I think this year is showing us that we've hit a bit of a brick wall here. Okay, so what we're saying is, look, you cannot treat small businesses like this. You cannot treat those at the bottom end, if you like, employees like this. This is a proposal here which delivers more money for the employee, takes the pressure off the small businesses, and okay, it's a form of living wage, but it's something achieved. And if one, as it were, opted for this, members of Timwell wouldn't be letting down the low paid at all. It would be a recognition along the lines that Laurie suggested, that we need to really stop and think again.
And is this just one, yet another example, another symptom of the collective failure, perhaps, of the whole way in which we do government, in that we always look for middle ground, so we end up without having these big, deep conversations about pretty much everything in government?
In part, I think it is. I mean, if you look at the journey we've been on with the minimum wage and the living wage here, what seemed to happen was government published minimum wage regulations with a living wage in it, and then they were pressured by bodies like the Chamber of Commerce, and so they went back and had a rethink and decided to do something very different, something that wasn't supported by their own reports or paperwork, something that generally was a bad idea. They did that, and that still wasn't quite enough then for people like the Chamber, who then went back out and said, actually, this is still not going to work, you need to make more changes and more changes. When what government should have done at the outset is said, actually, we had a plan here, and the plan was to get us to a living wage and provide business support to help businesses adapt and transition. And we haven't done that second bit, because that bit's quite difficult, that bit's hard, and that's why it's not happened. So instead of doing the hard thing and sticking by it, they've actually opted for what I think they thought would be the easier solution. And it's turned out that that actually hasn't been the case. And now they're on the back foot yet again. But it all stems from their failure to tackle that hard question, which is, how do you support businesses? So I wouldn't support, for example, a tax credit, because I think subsidising some employers through the front door is not the solution. You don't want to end up in a situation where you're basically subsidising payroll. That's what we did during COVID. It's not a long-term fix. But there are lots of things government could do to help those businesses in other ways. And some of that is by helping them invest, by helping them grow their customer base, by getting more tourists on the island. You know, there's lots of things that government can and should be doing
You retain that level of taxing for the lowest paid then?
So if the way I would look at it is, I would be, I know you've called it a tax credit, but I think that's a simplified version of basically saying you need to reduce the tax burden by about 300 quid. Yeah, yeah. The way I would do that is by changing national insurance rates and thresholds rather than offering.
Yes, and the reason we didn't take that particular route was for the very point you made a little bit earlier, which is the government accept and admit that their income is dependent upon those in work, you know, the bottom end upwards. Yeah. And it's this fear that the government has had a long time. Let me give you a little bit of a story. 10 years ago, I went to the Treasury and I said, what on earth are we doing here for the low paid with this NI? And the answer I got fits exactly with what Laurie said, and it's this: well, we can't afford to do it. Now, Laurie's point is right, that yes, we should be trying to fix thresholds, but the government at the moment can't afford it. And what we're saying is, look, our tax strategies, as it were, falling apart here. If we don't act sort of on a pro tem basis before rethinking things, then we're not being fair to the low paid, and we're seriously not being fair to businesses. So again, I mean, I hate to say it, Phil, we're in agreement.
So I've always had an issue with this idea that the government can't afford this, actually, because I think that is just not true. I think if you look at the numbers, government reserves are growing year on year. We've got more money in the bank now than we had at the start of this administration. But also, as Chris has already highlighted, increasing the minimum wage like this is going to generate more money for the government in tax receipts. So the government could choose to say, right, we're going to make this cost neutral for the government. All the money we're going to raise through extra taxes, we're actually going to plough back into reducing those taxes on low-paid people. They could do that. They could make it cost neutral. But at the minute, they haven't made any suggestion that they're going to do that. And the Treasury Minister is just saying, wait for the budget, wait for the budget. And that's a real problem, because at the minute, there's lots of uncertainty. What they should be doing is saying, this is the minimum wage increase, and here's what we're doing to help everyone. And they should have announced all that at the same time. Even in the UK, they would have done that. They'd have said in the budget, we're going to do X. They haven't done that. And for some reason, they're unwilling to. I think, again, it's because this is all being done last minute as a result of panicky government U-turns, because they don't have the nerve to tackle the difficult problems.
And look at the record. Look how bad it is. Oh, let's go to 22% tax. Oh, no, let's drop it to 21. Oh, no, let's have a health levy. Oh, no, let's not have a health levy. Oh, let's get rid of the MyCard. Oh, goodness me, what a mess. I mean, this is a Treasury that's lost the plot, and it's time to really seriously sit down and say, what is our tax policies? What is our strategy? How are we going to protect both business and those on, as what we call, minimum rates of pay? And also, and not discussed, is how do we make government itself more affordable? Because the money that's going to be coming out from the low-paid pay package here, which they seem to need, is going to feed a government where rates of pay are significantly higher. So what's actually happening is the private sector has been drained to the benefit of the public sector. Let's be clear about a point that Laurie made earlier on about helping this business, about helping the private sector. The private sector, for all sorts of reasons, which, you know, we won't dwell on now, have really been up against it in terms of trying to develop improved efficiency and productivity to keep available margins. They've been doing that now for a number of years. And at the end of that process of all that action, Alex Allison comes in and say, right, your gross pay goes up 10%. I mean, it's been such a shock. And that room for the private sector businesses to, as it were, absorb this, it's gone. And yet there's a sort of anger in the private sector, quite legitimately. What's government done about its productivity and efficiency? Why is it that the private sector should be burdened with cost that ultimately feeds an organisation that has not made accountable a concept of productivity and efficiency? So it's not a happy place at the moment that we're in.
And I think that's a fair point, actually. And I think, again, that stems from failings in our political system, in that it's very hard for independent politicians to make big changes because it will all fall on their neck. And it's difficult when you don't have that majority in Parliament to say, right, we're doing this now. It's going to be difficult, but we're doing it. And whether you like or loathe, you know, the stuff that Boris Johnson did in the UK or the stuff that Keir Starmer's doing at the moment, he's doing the things he said he was going to do because he has a majority and he has the ability to do that. Whereas here, what seems to happen is government makes a decision, they realise it's not going to be very popular, and immediately they panic, and inevitably that results in U-turn and policy fudges and all sorts of stuff. And I think that's part of the problem. Even the efficiencies programme is something of a joke, because it's £10 million a year they're going to save on a £1.3 billion budget. I mean, seriously?
Why are we at the end of a 10-year period where two administrations that has failed to find efficiencies and productivity, as we approach, we can see on the horizon the election, we're starting to declare about saving money. I mean, you know, that's a bit of a joke.
Can we look, because I think we should move into some of these areas. Yeah. But first of all, could we just have I'll ask you, do you agree or disagree with the basic principle that people on the lowest wage should be getting a living wage And if they do get that living wage, is that going to benefit the Manx economy, or is it not going to benefit the Manx economy?
So I think my position and my party's position for a long time has been that the living wage should be our statutory minimum. People should be able to go to work and work a full week and earn enough to put a roof over their heads and participate in society. I don't think that's particularly contentious. Is that good for the economy? Yes, it is, because when you're only earning low amounts of money, you tend to spend it all because you have to. You don't have a choice. You have to buy food and pay rent and pay your electricity bills. You don't have a lot of headroom to start saving that money up and putting it in a bank and investing it in stocks and shares. So the reality is, paying low-paid workers more, that money tends to circulate more in the economy, which is good for business, it's good for VAT receipts, it's good for everything. And so, yes, absolutely, it's something we should be doing. And I think when I've talked to businesses, most businesses would agree. I mean, you might be surprised that only around 2% of workers on the Isle of Man are actually earning the minimum wage, because most businesses on the island pay above that anyway. And they're not required to. They're doing that, some of them because they think it's the right thing to do, some of them because labour market forces them to. But ultimately, the number of people we're talking about earning the actual minimum wage is not a lot of people at all. What you have seen is a growth in the number of people earning between the minimum and the living wage. And that's largely inflationary and cost pressures that are driving some of that stuff up, because the living wage has increased by so much compared to what people are actually taking home.
Chris?
To shorten the programme, I suppose I could say, well, yeah, I absolutely agree. And what the forum has done, he's recognised exactly those points and said, OK, the ambition of Tim Wool was to get to a concept of living wage. OK, as Laurie says, they've veered off now in a completely different direction. But this is a perfectly constructive way of saying, yes, we have achieved something, but not the way the government's presenting it. And it's very disappointing to me that Alex Allinson's clinging to this concept of we're going to stand by this gross figure. It's all about what people take home, and let's leave it at that, because we're in agreement.
And it does actually work, doesn't it? I mean, yes. In terms of the money circulating in the economy, which then means that actually government gets more tax take and businesses do better.
And actually, the simplest solution for government is to stop taking the money up front. So rather than creating an administrative system where you give people rebates or credits, actually just change the way you tax them in the first place. And ultimately, that's what the economic strategy said we needed to do. The unspoken part of that strategy, though, is if you're going to tax workers less, you have to tax somebody else more to balance it out. That's the nature of the beast. And you can argue about how much of those savings could you find through efficiencies and all the rest of it, but the reality is you're not going to save all of that money through driving efficiencies in government. There has to be a counterbalance somewhere. And it's the counterbalance that government has never managed to tackle, because they are not interested in, you know, land tax. They're not interested in taxing capital gains. They're not interested in looking at corporate tax. All these other things that other jurisdictions do, our government has said, we're not touching those. Okay. Fine, that's a policy decision. If you're not touching those, all you're left with is what you're taxing workers. And then you really are left with the only thing you can do to lower workers' taxes is to reduce government expenditure. And I think we all know that that's just not going to happen to the scale that is needed to deal with the fact that these tax rises are going to hit people. And so government, I think, has to be willing to look back at that economic strategy and do the thing that actually the experts have said you probably need to do, which is to look at broadening your tax base to tax other activity aside from workers. Because while government follows a policy approach of saying the tax burden on the Isle of Man is going to be borne by working people, the reality is you're never going to see the economic growth that we need to get out of this kind of doom spiral that we seem to be in.
I can recognise a lot of that. What I would say is that, yeah, I agree that the number of people on the minimum wage is somewhat limited. I mean, Laurie says 2% is probably in reality somewhat a little bit more than that. But this proposal that the forum's put forward is modest in terms of cost, and forgive me if we've already covered this, but the gain from going the way we're asking them to go is actually will result in more income flowing in other ways. But if we carry on down the route that the government now want to go, just declaring this gross figure, let me be clear, the impact upon the private sectors, small businesses and medium-sized businesses, because there are the differential issues that kick in, and we were trying to avoid that as well, is now starting, because Alex Allen says, OK, you've got 4 or 5 months or whatever it is to get ready. Well, what is the get ready? Withdrawing investment programmes, reducing staff, reducing hours, reducing, you know, number of days in the week, all will produce suppressed economic activity, and it's a worry. So this is what we're proposing is Alex Allison must stop clinging to this growth pay thing. Ask Timwald to understand better what they've agreed, because I don't think they've looked into it to this degree. In fact, I'm certain they haven't. They've got to recognise the fact that their thinking heads in the Treasury are not thinking about things that they need to think about. Adopt this policy and then give ourselves the opportunity in the next House to start getting our tax strategies right. Because we're in the wrong place at the moment.
Do either of you have any sympathy with the Treasury Minister in as much as effectively he may actually agree with everything you're saying, but he has a Timwald approved policy that he has to fulfil. He has to reach agreement in Council of Ministers for any radical Treasury related proposal that he wishes to bring forward. Is he not stymied by the system?
Do you want to answer that?
My view on that is no. I have very little sympathy at this point. Timwald had a policy which the government U-turned on, so it's clear that they can when they want to. And we've only heard this week that the government is actually quite willing to ignore legal requirements when it suits them. So the idea that the Treasury is bound or feel bound in any way, I think, is a bit laughable. But the reality is they've had alternative proposals presented to them. I presented one myself that said, let's phase this in two steps to give businesses more time to adjust, and that was thrown out. I said we should put some business support in place for these, and they've threw that out as well. Treasury have had things presented to them in terms of options, and they have steadfastly said, no, this is the right approach. And if the minister is proposing and actively championing a policy he fundamentally disagrees with, then he should probably resign. That's the way you do it. You say, no, I'm sorry, but I can't support that policy. I don't think it's good for the island, and I'm not going to be the one responsible for it. And you hold your hands up and you say, Chief Minister, get someone else to do it. If the blocker really is the Council of Ministers, that is an option open to the Treasury Minister.
Looking at the deeper issues last night in the forum meeting, and there are three fundamental issues which link us more, I suppose, to the effort I'm putting into what I call future IOM. It's not about specific policies. It's about pillars of government that are required to be put in place if we're going to have better government. And the three issues are: our democracy currently is fading. More and more power is going to the individual departments, sort of steering away somewhat from ministers. And they, in turn, are separating themselves from the electorate. There are ways to improve efficiency and productivity in government, and it requires... I don't want to set Laurie off too much here, but it's linked to the concept of... unified government. And the third thing, and this is perhaps relevant to this discussion now, is we need much, much better high-level strategic thinking. And what we're doing at the moment, wrongly, is we're looking and getting the strategic thinking from operating officers in departments. That's inadequate for those elected. What's necessary is to have a set of departments really focused on operational delivery. And high-level strategic thinking, it's an art form to create it. And what Timwald and what the Council of Ministers need is much, much better high-level strategic thinking. So that's certainly lacking in Treasury. And I think it's been self-evident in a whole range of ways in the last number of years. So do I blame Alex Allinson? Yes, I do. Because, if you're going to carry on with a flawed system, then you're going to get flawed results. And yeah, you're right, you should stand down if things aren't where you believe they should be. But that's not the end of it. The end of it, how do we get to a situation where the advice coming through with regard to our tax strategy is good and can be recognised by everybody, supported and trusted? And there's a lot of work to do under those three principles. I shan't be talking about policy. I hope to talk to as many candidates for standing for the next election as I can, because so often highly well-meaning, successful candidates come in, they're sucked into the system, they're sucked into the departments, their arms are come round from the offices.
This is the point I suppose I was trying to make in the question in the first place. Yeah. The system, in the way that it is currently created, doesn't allow for or doesn't encourage deep strategic thinking. It actually requires the complete opposite. I mean, you mentioned there the minister could resign if he disagrees with the direction of council of ministers. If every minister in council of ministers that ever there has been had resigned because they disagreed fundamentally with a particular direction that council was going, you wouldn't have had any MHKs left to be a minister.
I think that's kind of the problem with the system, is that when you get elected, you know, most people that get elected haven't had any experience with an organisation of that size or complexity, or even with parliamentary process itself. And so you walk in and immediately you can be thrust into a department and you get stuck in with the operational stuff, stuck in running a department. Then you end up, you know, being appointed minister, and that hasn't changed. So you're still very much focused on your department, but there isn't any support there, political support. So you're in there alone with what you might think of as your ideas and your ways to go and do things, but you're facing a kind of the inertia of, well, this is what we've always done, and this is the way we do things, and this is the advice we've got for you, and this is the government process. And overcoming a lot of that can be quite difficult. It's quite daunting. And so what inevitably happens is you get a sort of form of regulatory capture, where going in as a minister, all of a sudden you are not really there leading the ship. You're making the decisions, but based on advice and information you've been given by the status quo, almost. So changing things is quite hard, because you don't have people you can fall back on and say, guys, does this make any sense to you? Does this stack up?
But isn't that what Tynwald is for? Isn't that, I mean, not necessarily in the public side of Tynwald, but
so if you've got
Tynwald members are there,
yeah,
surely.
If you've got a good team, then absolutely you can do that. And if you've got a team that's all quite like-minded, again, that works pretty well. And that's where, from my perspective, political parties kick in, because actually if you go in there with a team of people that are all of the similar mind, you can really get stuff done. The problem you've got is Tynwald is not a team of people all of a similar mind. And you have then you're struggling with ministers and members of departments maybe not agreeing on the fundamentals of things. So actually, you're not really working with a unified force there. It's very disjointed, and that then results in disjointed decision making and disjointed conversations around the council of ministers table. I mean, Chris is right on that front. I was amazed when I walked into the Comyn room. I had always expected council ministers to be like a board of directors. They're there making those strategic decisions. The reality is, everything is operational. Every decision that comes through is a minister arguing their case for their department, rather than anyone being able to take a step back and say, right, what's the right thing for the island? And then when they do agree a big strategy, like the economic strategy, for example, actually, that's great. But then if the minister in a particular area doesn't agree with a particular part of it, it's not going to happen. So the economic policies in there around tax reform, for example, haven't moved. 2022, that was approved. 2025, Treasury have made no effort whatsoever to do any of those things, because Treasury fundamentally disagree with some of those recommendations. So even when you do have an overarching strategic approach to something, where individual ministers or individual departments don't subscribe to those views, nothing happens anyway.
I think at last we've found somewhere where we don't necessarily see eye to eye. Thank goodness. I'm sure you'll be pleased we've done that at last. But I think we're living in a world now where geopolitical stresses are growing, where financial issues and economic issues are becoming ever more turbulent. I've got real concerns around the idea that one should necessarily set in stone where you stand for every 5 years. Mm. I think we need a much more sophisticated capacity to provide advice and guidance to members of Tynwald right the way through the passage, and also a mechanism to make sure that the electorate feel engaged and involved in developments which weren't, as it were, obvious at the time of the election. That those two things could absolutely change our government, and we could be, you know, something to envy. And we're not that far away. We just need the courage to keep our system, but refine it, and then add these pillars to it that really make it shine. Give people, new people coming into politics, particularly if they've not had any business background at all. It's difficult, you know. I mean, they can't be. They need really good advisors, and those really good advisors need to sit beyond the operational officers in departments. But that's where we're stuck at the moment, and that's why so often things arrive in the Council of Ministers and then ultimately and later on go wrong, because each minister's sort of really focused on what their officers are saying what their department should or shouldn't be doing. And it's sort of too difficult to really dive down into all the other issues in the other departments. That's why you need this overarching capacity. Certainly not any fixed capacity. You need that strategic thinking to be appointed subject to the issue that Council of Ministers and Tim will want to consider. Also, the way our system's working at the moment is working against good opposition. I mean, it's now pretty well straightforward to get something that a senior officer has persuaded his minister to do. That minister's got a very good chance of getting it through, even if the members in the department actually disagree with it, and even if a significant number of the Council of Ministers disagree. What heart has an opposition member got to really stand up and say, no, I don't agree with this, or yes, I do, but that's not right? Because the process of going through the Council of Ministers is going to get it through the House anyway. So
you were both sat in Tynwald when the Lisvain report was tucked away on the darkest and dustiest of shelves with very little change made. That was an opportunity missed to allow for the kind of strengthening of the scrutiny function of Tynwald.
I think there's always been a nervousness from a government perspective to allow that to happen. And I think the problem you've got, as Chris rightly identifies, it's a rare day that you get something through Tynwald that the Council of Ministers fundamentally objects to. If they're indifferent about something, or if they don't really understand it, quite often you can get it through. Or if the errors in the things they're presenting are so fundamentally obvious that even ministers can see them, then actually you can have a good day. But actually, 90% of the time, you know, if Comyn don't want it to happen, it's not going to happen, because they absolutely have control of the House of Keys. And in principle, I've got no issue with that. If they had gone out to the public and actually had a majority of people on their side at the election, they'd have a mandate to do that. But they just don't. And so what you end up with is a system where not even a majority, you know, it's five ministers out of nine. That's all you need. That's a decision. And so five people in Tynwald are the ones making some of these decisions, because the rest of the Comyn go along with it under collective responsibility. So do the department members. And then all they've got to really do is convince one backbencher to support them. And actually, that's a lot easier than it sounds.
It's a big, a high-risk strategy, though, if only five of your ministers supported a controversial policy. As Chief Minister, you might be tempted to say, actually, maybe we should have a rethink on this. And actually, then that causes some of the problem we were talking about earlier in terms of that big strategic thinking, because then you end up trying to make some level of compromise and you water down the initial proposal.
Well, Sir John Aldridge's 2014 Single Legal Entity report, his final paragraph is, guys, if you really want good, my terminology, my paraphrasing, not his, of course, if you really want high-level quality strategic thinking, you really need to do this, you know? I mean, and the other thing within those pillars, going back to the democratic side, is that the position of the Chief Minister is currently too weak. He is pretty well a hire and fire of ministers, you know, and it's a pretty crude mechanism to run a government, if that's all you've got. You haven't got the system of parties in other jurisdictions, and we could have a discussion about that, which I think best leave, because we might have different views on that. but there is an opportunity to increase the authority of the Chief Minister and give him or her the opportunity or the requirement to really keep their fingers on the pulse.
So why did it work?
Let me just finish this point. Yeah, to keep the fingers on the pulse of the population's views, and if necessary, and when necessary, particularly coming back to your point about a split Council of Ministers or a split House, the Chief Minister, once, twice or three times a year, should be taking key issues to the people and say, on a referendum basis, there's nothing wrong at all with introducing the concept in the appropriate time, in the appropriate way, and on an advisory basis to bring in the concept of checking back with the public.
Why was Council of Ministers so successful when it began? You know, we had a remarkably similar position back then. It seemed that that whole idea of working together for the collective good was a more prevalent thing.
So I think the challenge you've got is there's a lot more noise now than there was 40 years ago. Everything's on social media. It's very easy to get that instant reaction. And I think politicians have a tendency to panic. And again, that's partly, I think, because they don't have the confidence in their own views. They don't have the conviction that I think you'd expect them to have. So they're presenting policies that maybe aren't really theirs. They're not really wedded to. So when things start getting difficult, it's easier for them to say, well, actually, no one likes this. We're going to do something different. And I think that's a challenge. And that generally comes because I think people go into politics on the Isle of Man for all the right reasons, but most people don't go in knowing what they want to get out the other side. People run on one issue sometimes or one topic, but actually that's not the topic you might end up in charge of. I remember talking to a Ramsey commissioner just after the election, saying, and so well done, you, congratulations on being elected. And they said, well, what happens next? We're talking them through. And I said, so at the AGM, you could be given a portfolio. And they were sort of looking at me thinking, what do you mean? I know nothing about housing and parks and leisure and all the rest of it. Surely they couldn't put me in charge of something straight away. So actually, they can. That's how politics works on the Isle of Man. And that's not good sometimes. So you do end up, I think, with that kind of core weakness inside the council minister's structure. And Chris is right, there needs to be more regular engagement and touch points with the population, with people in between elections. And again, a party structure is the best way of doing that, because you can have regular public meetings where anyone can come along and talk and engage, and there is a kind of a structure built around it. But ultimately, I think, what's that quote, a bad system beats a good person every time? And that's the problem that we have at the minute, is the system is poor. And so you have to be a really exceptional group of people, really exceptionally committed to your end goal to make things work in the way that you want them to work.
I think
it's very easy to do that in times of plenty, when things are going well, when the economy is growing, when everything's going from strength to strength. Actually, it's very easy. And our system, as it is actually very effective at making decisions when you're trying to spend money. When you're trying to do things, it's actually quite good. Where it falls down completely is where you're trying to do anything that is difficult. Even the smallest of things that is going to be contentious is very, very hard to do in our system.
At the beginning of the ministerial system, 1986, I think it was.
1990.
Was it?
Yeah.
When it came in, the island was on the up economically. Mm. The civil service was manned in broad terms by very experienced people who lived through much more difficult times. They had a different culture and mindset. And, you know, I'm an old fart, so perhaps I would say this, but the profile of the politicians then, going back sort of 40 years or so, very much people who'd worked through those very difficult times. And so you had very experienced civil servants and yeah, let's be blunt, very experienced politicians, often covered in cuts and bruises of their previous failures that they were not going to deliver back. And so at that time, the government, the system was in good hands, and it was also a lot smaller and leaner. But, you know, the easy times, the good times have really had the wrong impact.
And I think we're also stymied by, if you look at what happened after the financial crash, our governments here decided that they weren't going to go into full-on austerity mode like the UK, but actually, equally, they weren't going to keep investing. So we've had a kind of slow trickle of austerity over the last 10 to 15 years. So we're still feeling some of the impacts from 2008, 2009 today, because government never really right-sized itself after the VAT crash. It never really changed the way it was operating, and we've kind of meandered through it. And it's kind of working and kind of isn't, but actually the problem is you can only do that for so long before something breaks, and it feels like we're at that point where the string is snapped or is about to snap, because government has been treading water for too long rather than actually doing things.
We're going to start agreeing.
Well, I'm going to disagree. Am I allowed to?
Yes.
Bearing in mind I was in the Council of Ministers after that financial crash, I thought that we'd made a pretty good start at trying to turn the screws on government finance. And
I think it's fair to say it may have drifted subsequently. Probably did, but I think it's fair to say since I've been involved in Manx politics the last 15 years, I would say the answer to that is it probably hasn't been. It felt like it was starting to go off the rails in the kind of 2011 to 16 era, and then with the last administration, that failure to invest significantly.
Great, we've got further opportunities.
Well, unfortunately. Well, go on. We've got about a minute left.
I agree with you, Phil, that the 11 to 16 did an awful lot of business around saving money. The sad thing is, as Laurie says, I'm agreeing with him. Since then, it's stalled. You know, that's the truth of the matter. But you know from my involvement that way back then I was saying, we can't stall, we've got to change, we need to reform, keep our system, but just refine it and make it better. We haven't done that.
Can I ask, do you not think that part of the problem is that we think here in five-year cycles because we have no certainty, whereas when you have a jurisdiction which has a kind of party structure, you can and you should be thinking beyond the election, thinking, actually, how are we going to be doing this in 5, 10, 15 years' time? Whereas here, actually, the council of ministers and Tim Auld even can't think in those terms, even let alone beginning to plan in those terms.
We're agreeing again, but
it's
not a question of choosing between, I believe, what I'm saying about how strategic, high-quality strategic thinking comes in. It's party politics or that. I mean, I'm hoping to encourage and persuade those who want to establish party politics to think the same way. So, yes, we do think in five-year sort of blips but high-level strategic thinking, quality provided, fully supported, will ensure there's a bridge over that.
That was Ramsay MHK Laurie Hooper and Local Economy Forum spokesman Chris Robertshaw. I'm Phil Gorn, Gorhamayos and Geistercrum. Thanks for listening.